the time of the retreat where we have a speaker, and it's an Al-Anon speaker. And I've only known Linda for one day, but I feel like I know her my whole life because she's such a sweet, loving, kind woman. I had the privilege of driving up from New York with her and Scott, and it was a great drive because they're very interesting people, especially when they go to Manhattan and they get on a bus and they meet people and they love it. So it was great. So anyway, I'll introduce Linda, Scott's wife.
Thank you. Good evening. My name's Linda, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Hi. And it's Saturday Night Live in Graymore, right? Okay. Well, I feel outnumbered here. Are there any Al-Anons in the room? Excellent. Okay, yay. And I feel very honored to be here. Very, very honored. But Al-Anon has taught me to ask for what I need. And in some areas of the country, they have a moment of silence before meeting, and then they have the Serenity Prayer. And my understanding is one time somebody asked Lois Wilson, who is the co-founder of Al-Anon, she was married to Bill, somebody asked her what she did in the moment of silence. And she said, "I invite God to the meeting." So what I need is a moment of silence, and if you'd be willing to ask the God of your understanding to come to this meeting. I feel like I'm prayed up, but I always think that until I get up here, and then I get the eye contact. So I need to do a little jump start of a moment of silent prayer, please. Thank you. And now I'm not up here by myself. You know, I've got the people that were in the rooms before me. I've got the loving blessings of my sponsor. I've got the respect of your eye contact, which is a little overwhelming to me. So I guess what you'd like to know is, how did I qualify for Al-Anon? Well, I qualify because I seem to have been born into a family that has a dad, and I've known my dad all of his life, and that's 62 years, so you don't have to do any other math. And for 62 years, I've seen my dad drink, and most of the time I've seen him drunk. He's now in his mid-80s, and he says he's going to continue to do three things for the rest of his life, and he names them like sporting events. I'm going to play golf, I'm going to fish, and I'm going to drink. And because I'm a member of Al-Anon, that's just fine with me. And if this gentleman walked into the room, you would absolutely embrace him with enthusiasm. He's one of the most interesting people you'd want to hang out with. But I qualify because that was the household I grew up in. Secondly, I seem to marry alcoholics, and then I seem to divorce them. And then I seem to marry them, and then I seem to divorce them. And then I seem to marry them. And I am in my third marriage with my now and forever husband, Scott, okay, who is a recovering alcoholic, go figure. And I give birth to alcoholics, okay? So this is why I qualify to be here in front of you. In fact, I absolutely adore and love alcoholics. And Scott has pointed out to me that I have a very good intuition on picking them out. It's like something, you know, I've got a predisposition of being able to have my antenna go beep, 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 beep when you walk within, 3 feet of me, 10 feet, 30 feet. I can pick them out from a distance. Many times we're going to conferences, and Scott's only talked to the AA guy over the phone, and we'll get into an airport, and Scott will say, "You go pick them out. I'll go get the luggage," you know, because I can, and Scott is always trying to improve recovery in our hometown of Nashville, Tennessee. And so for my birthday several years ago, he gave me, 300 or 500 business cards. And he said, "These cards will be very helpful." I said, "Okay." He says, "You know, you're so attracted to alcoholics." He said, "But, you know, it would just save time." He said, if you go to the grocery store and you look over there and you see somebody you're attracted to, you could hand them one of these cards. I go, "Okay. I'll share the card with you." The front of it has my name, phone number, a couple of butterflies, that sort of thing. Listen to what it says on the back. "Hi, my name is Linda. I am a member of Al-Anon. I find you attractive, so I suggest you go to the nearest treatment center and have an assessment done." uh, Oh, yeah. He said, just think of how much time that would save. And I think that's probably true. And thanks to Al-Anon, I can stand up here and say, I love alcoholics. And I can also say, I am not the enemy. Okay? My love, I have almost loved alcoholics to death. And until I got an Al-Anon and knew the difference about detachment and loving, my oldest daughter just turned, well, she's like 40 and a half now. I can't remember how many 39 birthdays she had before that, but she's 40 now. And this August, about mid-month, she will celebrate 19 years of sobriety. I think that's incredible, yes. AA parented her so well. But I have to tell you, it came a difference. She graduated from college. She came home. She's newly sober. She's every night going to a meeting, and then they would all the young people would kind of end up at my house. I'm newly divorced, and I'd hear them playing cards and laughing and everything, and I'd go, isn't that wonderful? I know where my daughter is, and these other parents know where their children are, their adult children are. And that went on for quite some time, and then pretty soon it dawned on me. She's a college grad. She's sleeping all day. She's going to AA and drinking a lot of coffee at night. She's staying up playing cards all night. She's sleeping in. She's going to AA. I thought, And so she came down the stairs one day, and I handed her half of the water bill, her half of the phone bill, her half of the electric bill. And I said, you know, this is you're living in my home. You're living in an apartment upstairs in my home, and this is your part of it. And she says a very, very profound thing. She says, Mom, the day you treated me like an adult was the day I could be one. And she was in her, she turned sober at 21. She says, you know, go figure. When it was legal for her to drink, she stopped drinking. That's, you know, that's alcoholic thinking, in my opinion. I don't know. So I tell that story because there are a lot of us that have, you know, Al-Anon believes that alcoholism is a family illness, that it can be, it's passed on from generation to generation. I said about my dad, I said about my daughter. For some reason, it skipped my generation, although I did a lot of bonding drinking. I have to tell you that. I did a lot of bonding drinking. But I just didn't have the knack, is what Scott says. I just wasn't any good at it, is what he says, so... whatever. So, and I, as a Al-Anon, in Al-Anon, I choose not to drink. Now, we get this a lot, like, oh, you're in Al-Anon, you can drink. And I get this a lot about women in Al-Anon that I'm going to sponsor, that they drink. But our fifth tradition says that we would give support and encouragement to the alcoholic. I don't think kissing a glass of wine is encouragement to the alcoholic that I'm married to. So as an Al-Anon, I choose not to drink. In fact, I carry it a step further. When I get a woman in Al-Anon that she's asked me to sponsor her, so the first thing we're going to do is we're going to start going through the steps. And that means I'm going to be dedicating my time, and I want her to be present when we start going through those steps. So I'll say, okay, would you be willing to contract with me? And during this time that we're going through the steps, I'm going to ask you not to drink or drug. And usually they say, well, I don't drink or drug anyway. I said, okay, that's fine, but would you be willing? But every now and then I'll get a woman that I'll say, would you be willing not to drink or drug while we're going through the steps together? And she says, not drink. She said, well, my cousin's wedding is next weekend, and they're going to be serving champagne. I go, that's just fine, but I'd ask you to drink Coke, Coca-Cola, or something else besides the champagne when we're going through the steps together. And then she might say, but my high school reunion's coming up. And I go, that's just fine, but I'm going to ask you not to drink. And if she keeps arguing too much, I hand her an AA schedule, okay? because if to me, I need these women present, and I want them to be present in their own life. And so I choose not to drink. Okay. I'd been hanging out in Al-Anon quite a while when I was invited to San Diego. I don't even know how many years ago that was. I was invited to go out there to be on Scott. That was our Scott and I's first international. We got to go out there together. It was wonderful. And I was invited to be on one of the panels, not tell my story like tonight, but I was given an assignment ahead of time. And I think our topic was living with sobriety after the honeymoon's over. And since I was in my third marriage, they thought I was a good planner of honeymoon. So I thought, you know, that's good. And I think I did a good job doing the research. See, since you knew the topic ahead of time, I could go to our Al-Anon conference-approved literature which the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is not conference-approved literature for Al-Anon. That's been going on. That conversation has been going on for over 20 years. I've been in Al-Anon 20 years, and it was going on the day I came in. It's still going on. I don't go there. It's almost an outside issue, in my opinion. I love the Big Book. I was taken through the steps the first time from the Big Book, and I can share that with you because I'm in a room of loving people of the Big Book, okay? But it is not Al-Anon conference-approved literature. But anyway, I'm doing the research on living with sobriety after the honeymoon's over, but we do have some great literature around that. We've got Sex and Intimacy, a little booklet. It's no longer in print. I think they should have put some pictures in it, and I think it would have stayed in print a little longer. But anyway, and we've got The Dilemmas of the Alcoholic Marriage. We've got a brand-new book that just came out called Choices, which is all about relationships. So Al-Anon is about relationships, but in truth, it's not just saving relationships. It's about saving lives. So anyway, we're out there in San Diego, and I have to tell you ahead of time that I really feel like I did a good job to prepare for my 15-minute talk around living with sobriety after the honeymoon's over. But the woman that introduced herself before me, she told my entire Al-Anon story, just in the way she introduced herself, and I forgot everything else. And this is what she did. She was from Georgia. She was even more southern than I am, okay? I'm from Tennessee, and Georgia is even southerner. And this is what she'd say. She said, "Hello, my name is so-and-so. I'm from Georgia. I'm a member of Al-Anon, and I am addicted to mood-altering men." I go, okay, that's it, that's me. And I don't have to apologize for that. You know, my story, you know, the video of my story looks wonderful. I can tell it, it's a great life. I'm an only child. I grew up in West Texas. I graduated from high school in 1964. It was a time of innocence. We had sidewalks. I roller skated up and down that sidewalk for miles and miles. If you want to know what my hometown life was like, there was a book, Under the Friday Night Lights. They made a TV show out of it. That's where I grew up. That's Odessa. And being an only child meant that my parents could give me a lot of stuff. My parents came from a very poor background. They lived in rural Oklahoma. They'd both lived without electricity and indoor plumbing at times in their life. And together as a couple, they put together an unbelievable estate. And since I'm an only child, I benefited from that. I had all of the budget for shoes, all the budget for clothes. They showed me love by giving me stuff. You know, and all through this, I never heard my mother and dad argue about anything except my dad's drinking. But it didn't seem like that would be causing any problems. I couldn't say that my dad's drinking caused any problems any more than I could have stood up and said, man, this family has got to stop eating macaroni and cheese. Macaroni and cheese is killing this family. We've absolutely got to stop it because it was an everyday event. And my dad had to entertain a lot, and so he's drinking out at the country club. He's taking people out to dinner. I see it as a party. I see it as a very nice party. My girlfriend's dad, in the meantime, I'd go pick her up in the morning. He's already drinking. He worked graveyard. He's already drinking in his underwear. He's taking his teeth out, and he's drinking out of a bottle when I go pick her up in the morning, and I made a judgment. I thought, wow, that's kind of unusual. But see, since my dad would be drinking in the country club, I didn't think he had a problem. But what happened during that time is what I call step zero started happening, that unbelievable void that we get right here in the gut. I've heard us talk about it. We try to fill it up with things, and we don't even know it's happening. I mean, I look back in my life, and there was laughter. I traveled with my parents. They gave me a convertible in high school. I mean, I was given a lot of stuff, and they absolutely love and adore me. But I had this step zero happening, and I did not know that was going on until I got into Al-Anon, and I got my hands on some Alateen literature. And you get this little pop quiz, and we're going to discover that we're not the first flowers to bloom in the garden sometimes, okay? I recommend whatever program you're in, you get your hands on some Alateen literature. This let me know why I didn't do so well on that math test in the seventh grade. because when I'd be at school, I'd be wanting to be home so I could keep my eyes on things and make sure things were okay. And then when I'd get home and have to step over my dad's clothes because my mother had thrown him out of the house again, I was thinking, how can I get out of here? Listen to this little pop quiz and see if any of it. It says, has your life been affected by someone else's drinking? Alateen is for you. Alateen is from 13 to 19, okay? It's the precursor for Al-Anon. Okay, so number one says, do you believe no one could possibly understand how you feel? Did you cover up your real feelings by pretending you don't care? Do you feel neglected, uncared for, unloved? Did you have a problem with authority figures? Did you stay out of the house as much as possible? Were holidays frequently interrupted by someone else's drinking? Are you afraid to speak up for fear that drinking or fighting will start again? I mean, bingo. Didn't some of us have some of those feelings when we were that age? So my part is that this step zero happened because that's what was going on in my household. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't loved, that I wasn't cared for. I would go for days and punish my dad by not speaking to him. I was always one of those pre-Al-Anon saying, if you're going to act that way, I'm going to show you and I'm going to act a different way. I can remember that I would go for days and not speak to my dad because I was angry with him about something. And now my dad just recently moved into an apartment on our property. I have belly laughs with him. It's just unbelievable, okay? And it all is a result of Al-Anon. It's all a result of Al-Anon. He's an incredible man. So I have step zero. My mother and daddy are only fighting about my dad's drinking. I want to get out of the house. I don't know I want to get out of the house because our house was where all the kids came over to hang out. Because, you know, back then it was big news. We had a ping pong table. Believe me, that was big, okay? So all the kids after school would come to our house to play ping pong. And I decided not to go off to college. I think I was encouraged not to go off because of my parents. Because some way, at this point in time, I had become the net. They're doing the tennis match, and I'm the net. And if I leave, that's going to make the net disappear. And I don't think any of us knew this consciously, okay? This is just what was going on. And so I lived at home, and I went to a junior college there in Odessa. And I'd been going on that campus probably for less than 2 months, and this young man came across campus. Man, I could have given him one of these business cards because my heart went pitter-pat, pitter-pat, and, you know, something in him went pitter-pat, pitter-pat, because in 2 weeks we never had a date, but he asked me to marry him. And I thought that was a great idea. And I took him to my parents, and I said, hey, we want to get married. And they started asking all of those, you know, really pesky questions like, shouldn't he have a job first? And we go, that's just details. We'll work it out, you know. And they actually fought that marriage because it didn't look like a good idea to them. And because I think they fought it, that kept us as a common, we had a common enemy. And within 6 months, we are married. And I am walking down the aisle in a storybook wedding. I had a white gown on, and I deserve to wear it, by the way. I think part of my wanting to marry is I had been a good girl for about as long as I could be. And y'all can figure that out. We're adults. And so I walk down this aisle, and we have this storybook wedding, and we live happily ever after for the first 2 weeks. And then to celebrate our two-week wedding anniversary, my husband brought home two of his very best friends. Now, we're still students. You know, we're students. All of this young life, of this young married life, for a long time we were students. And he brought home two of his best friends. Cliff, I think, was probably in his history class, and their other best friend, Bud, came in between them in the cooler. Okay, and that night, to celebrate our 2 weeks of marriage, I saw Cliff kind of pass out, go to sleep on the couch. I saw my husband kind of pass out, go to sleep in our bed. And we're in married student housing, which is about the size of this table, if you'll remember. And I took the stance, the pre-Al-Anon stance. You know, I'm looking and said, these guys look like a bunch of fallen trees. And I'm not going to let my husband get away with that. I'm going to show him. I'm going to punish him. I'm going to let him know that he can't drink and get away and celebrate our 2 weeks of marriage. And I came up with a great idea. I had these unbelievable great ideas. That night, to punish my husband, I slept in the bathtub. Now, it was so logical at the time. I mean, it was ridiculous, yeah. I take my pillow, I take a blanket, and I sleep in the bathtub. And And that set up a walls for a long time. I get up with a backache. He gets up with a hangover. But it set up the dance of, if you're going to do that, I'm going to show you you can't get away with it. We'd been married about 2 years when my first daughter was born. And for some reason, I thought when we came home from the hospital, the fine print said, you're now adults, you're parents. So now you're going to live happily ever after. Evidently, he didn't get those same that same news because his lifestyle didn't change. We're students in on several different campuses. We kept moving around. In fact, in 16 years of marriage, we moved 13 times, and there were times that we even lived without an address. That's like homeless. And I think if you look at the history books that Lois and Bill Wilson, before they moved to the loving place of Stepping Stones, they had like over like 52, 57 different mailing addresses. And we desperately try to outrun this disease. Every time my husband would say, I think it'll be better if we move to Houston. Oh, it's going to be great if we go to Dallas. He wasn't trying to set me up. He didn't know he was trying to outrun the disease of alcoholism. He really believed it was going to be better. And because he believed it, I believed it. And what I know through Al-Anon is that you pack up the dishes, you pack up the kids' toys, you pack up the books, and you pack up the disease, and you move it on down the road. But we were, and which means you have no contact with community. You have to redo your finances over and over again to set up the deposits for the water, the electric, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So here we are. We have been trying to outrun the disease. We have a young daughter, and we're still students. And then one day he accidentally gets a job. And the reason I say accidentally is because he was drinking at his favorite saloon, which was a Holiday Inn bar. And the bartender, who he knew very well, said, I'm thinking about putting a little stage over there in the corner and maybe having somebody play the guitar, and that would keep people here longer, and they'd drink, and they'd want to come here and hear music and drink. Music is never about making music. It's always about selling alcohol, if you really look at that closely. That's what it's about. So he runs home. He grabs his guitar. He goes back, and he does this audition, and he gets this job. So now all of a sudden, in 1 week's time, he's making more money than we had seen in, like, months. And he does a gig at that Holiday Inn, and now they want him to go to another Holiday Inn 30 miles away, and I was okay. Then they wanted him to go, like, 120 miles away, and then pretty soon they wanted him to go 300 miles away, and they wanted him to go to Dallas and do all of those Holiday Inns. And I've got this young baby, and I did not think that man should go off without adult supervision. You better believe I didn't think that. I thought the only way we could stay together was if we stayed together. And I threw away what I didn't know then was a dream. I was one semester away from graduating with honors, and yet I just walked away from that. You know, I didn't have the conscious thought that maybe I should stay here and finish my college degree. I didn't have that thought because it was about him, okay? So I packed up the baby, I packed up the hot plate, and now we're living in Holiday Inns. And it's always in the telling. It looked like a great life. I'm up there with this baby. We're hanging out in the pool in the daytime. He's going down and working, and he comes home at night, you know, 2-3 o'clock in the morning. He kind of smells like, acts like, and looks like he's been to a party, but since it's work, it must be okay. And we're 30 days in one town, 30 days in another town, 30 days in another town. I'm packing up. I've got this baby. I'm in this hotel room. I'm going crazy. And I can't tell you why. I mean, this gut feeling is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And this lifestyle is not fitting or suiting me. Did I think a conscious thought of maybe I should go home and make a home base? No. I came up with another great idea. On Friday, my husband came in and I said, hey, I'm going to be the drummer in the band. He said, have you ever played drums before? And I said, that's just details. We'll work it out. Okay? So I took the bass player with me to a pawn shop on Saturday, and for $50, you can imagine what they look like, I bought a whole trap set of drums. I'm talking two ride toms, a floor tom, a hi-hat, a crash cymbal, a snare drum, a bass drum. Monday night, I was the drummer in the band, okay? You can't tell me we're not determined people. I needed to do that to be with him. It had nothing to do with love of music. It got me out of the room. And it got me there keeping an eye on him while he was working and drinking. And I have to tell you, this time in our life, it could look like a great time. We'd pull into these little towns, and there our name would be up on the marquee, and there our room would be ready in the Holiday Inn, and the innkeeper would get a babysitter because we started putting that into the contract, okay? Because I've got to be the drummer in the band. Somebody's got to take care of our daughter upstairs. And we became so well-known in Texas that all of the touring people, all of the really famous people would always find out where we were because we were the After Hours Club. Y'all may remember those. The law says you can no longer serve alcohol, so you lock the door and the party continues all night. And I tell this because I think that I did something that I'd probably get arrested for from family services in this day and age. The babysitter would eventually have to go home. She was probably a student. She needed to go to school the next morning. Meanwhile, I want to hang out with the guys and make music with them all night. And they would let me be the drummer with whoever. I mean, I became a very good drummer, and they would let me make music with them all night long, and they're drinking and partying and writing songs and drinking and partying and writing songs, and I needed to be there. Well, my daughter's upstairs by herself, so such a good mom that I am, I'd go upstairs and I'd take the phone off the hook, and then I'd go down in the bar and I'd take that phone off the hook, and every now and then I'd go over and listen to see if she was awake, and I thought I was really being a good mom and a good wife. And I'm totally lost all evidence of self in this. I am what I think I'm supposed to be, a good mother and a good wife. And we had a lot of success, and we moved a lot. And finally, through certain turn of events, we ended up in Nashville, Tennessee. And I thought, this is great. Where else could a songwriter, singer be but Nashville, Tennessee? And there's 8 years difference between my two girls, and I am pregnant with our second daughter. In fact, she turned a year old in Nashville. And now I'm thinking, we're going to live happily ever after. Because now he has a job, and we live in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, the progression of the disease is just that. And sometimes taking care of business isn't as important as the party. And business is very serious around the music in Nashville. And he became disillusioned. And it didn't happen. The success didn't happen as fast as he'd seen it for him in Texas. And he came in one day, and he announced, "Get packed. We're leaving. We're going back to Texas." And I have to tell you, that day, part of me died. I was so old, I could not have packed one more cardboard box. I was absolutely used up, exhausted, totally finished. And I said, I can't go. And he did this little trump card that he'd been holding over me for a long time. He said, I guess we just get a divorce then. And because I was so desperately afraid of being alone, I have so many abandonment issues, I would always say, oh, no, no, I'll do whatever you do, whatever you say, not to get a divorce, not to get a divorce. But this time he said, I guess we just get a divorce. And something in me said, I guess we do. And so our neighbor was an attorney. We paid him $50. And within 30 days back then, we get a divorce. And that husband, my new former husband, packs up his music instruments. He takes off and he goes back to Texas, and I keep him in my prayers. He married a young woman. They're raising a second family, and I wish him the best, because the happier he is, the better his relationship is with his, he is the natural father of my daughters, okay? And here's what he left in the rearview mirror. He left a 3-year-old, he left an 11-year-old, and he left the mom that says drummer in the band. Okay, and the attorney that handled the divorce said, there's a guy that's in real estate on the 25th floor of the First American Center, Bank Center downtown. I think you should go and talk to him. You're going to need to be making some money, and he's looking for an office manager. I did not know my control skills could be used to make money. See, I'd been controlling for a long time, and I go in there. And I get this job. Now I am managing shopping centers. I am managing the office. I am managing his daytimer. I am managing, and I'm getting paid for it. And I took to commercial real estate, and it took to me. There weren't a lot of women involved in commercial real estate during that time. I got my broker's license as fast as I could. I opened my own company. I am making megabucks. And I have to tell you that I turned my back on my two daughters the same way anybody would with a drug or a drink. the message I would give them would, I would call home and I'd say, y'all just stick something in the microwave for dinner because I have very, very important people in from out of town and I have to take them to dinner. Very important people. Or I'd say, hurry up, get ready, I've got to get you off to school because I've got a real power breakfast this morning. See, but I thought if I put enough zeros in the bank, my daughters and I would live happily ever after. This is what I truly believed. I truly believed I was doing everything I could to make us live happily ever after by making a lot of money. And I got a lot of strokes from community. You know, I'm a successful businesswoman. I'm at my dad, my parents are looking at me. I'm very successful. And Christmas comes, and I buy my daughter's stuff because that's what had been given to me to show love. So this Christmas, we had stuff. And when you have stuff at Christmas, you also have paper. And the photos come back, and I think our living room was about as this deep in paper. And here's the picture of the little daughter, the older daughter, and the mom, and all of this stuff. And I look at it, and we don't look too happy, you know. And I go, what's missing from this picture? A man. That's right. And I am now in my mid-30s. I don't think I have a lot of time, so I marry my boss. Now, now he had been asking me out, but he had been married at the time. So, and that was just details. He said, we'll work it out, you know. So here's the Cinderella story. Very successful businessman. Marries his secretary, who's turned out to be very good business person, adopts her two daughters. Adopts her two daughters. I gave him my two daughters legally. And he moves us into a mansion. It was a mansion. It had six bathrooms. It was directly across the street from the governor's mansion in Nashville, Tennessee. I mean, this is a perfect story. We are living the fast life. We are movers and shakers. We're developing shopping centers. We're traveling all over the world. We own about six sailboats. We have a wine cellar that would rival a small restaurant. We're in all of the proper clubs, like, you know, Friends of the 100-Year-Old Cognac Club and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. And something's wrong. Something's wrong. It's this whole year. Something's wrong. And I'd go to my doctor and I'd say, I think I'm going crazy. And he would look at my address and my lifestyle and he'd say, what do you have to complain about? And I'd go away. Okay. I'd go to my friends and I'd say, I really believe something awful is happening in my household and I don't know what it is. I think I'm going crazy. And they'd say, but you just got back from South America. Wasn't that a great trip? Yes, it was. Well, aren't you going to go to Jamaica next week? Yeah. And so what do you have to complain about? What did I have to complain about? I'd go away, you know. This is the time that my daughters are in private schools. We're buying the brand new cars, the first ones that come into Nashville, Tennessee. We're living this fast life. And I look back on it now, and it was like a movie. You know, up front, it looked great. But if you ever step behind the set, you would see that it was all sawdust and a lot of unhappy things were going on. And I would go over and over again, and I would say, I really think something bad is wrong. I really think I'm going crazy. And so we would have these terrible fights. And I couldn't tell you what we would be fighting over, but they'd be horrible fights. And so I didn't think a second divorce would look too good on my resume. So I picked out this doctor in the phone book, and I took this man that I was married to kicking and screaming into a very popular word at the time, and it was called marriage counseling. Okay? So we'd go into this doctor, and I would immediately start crying. Can't tell you why. I'm just weeping, weeping. And my second husband then would rock his chair back, fold his arms, and just totally shut down. And we'd do that, and pretty soon the doctor would get kind of bored. That's a pretty boring scene. And I can tell you, time and time again, I saw this man pick up a paperclip, open it up just right, make it kind of like that, and then he'd kind of twirl it like a little helicopter, you know. And then he'd see his watch, and he'd go, oh, you're out of time. And he'd tell me, you're too sensitive. And he'd tell my husband, you're not sensitive enough. And we'd go away. And we would have another horrible fight, and we'd show up at the doctor's office again, Well, you're too sensitive. You're not sensitive enough. Another horrible fight. You're too sensitive. You're not sensitive enough. And this repeated over and over and over again until one time we had such a horrible fight that I walked out on him. We were on a holiday down in the lower Florida Keys. He was actually on a holiday with his best friend. And I was just kind of a tag-along, I decided, and some very uncomfortable things happened. And I started the run toward Al-Anon. Now, I did not know it was a run toward Al-Anon. I just knew that I'd had enough because there was going to be a public scene in a very nice restaurant, and I didn't want to participate in another one of those. I'd always thought that volume was the voice of reason, okay? If I could tell it louder, maybe he'd get it. And I just wasn't willing to participate. So I went back to Nashville, Tennessee, and after a long, hard time. In fact, I was kind of stranded in the Miami airport overnight, and it was open to the public, and it wasn't a safe place. And here I am, a successful businesswoman with a lot of money in the bank, and I have my back up against the wall just trying to stay safe all night. I mean, I did a one-night stand as a bank lady, and I really defended my life that night. And I used a word, I said a prayer. I said, God, my life is unmanageable. How could I be in a situation like this? Now, unmanageable did not show up in my vocabulary. I managed. I managed shopping centers. I managed three businesses. I managed our office. Our cat and dog practically had daytimers on when they're going to the vet. You better believe this woman managed, okay? And here I am all night in the airport just trying to stay alive. And I get a flight back to Nashville, and this man comes home a couple of days later. And I did what I'd been taught to do. I waited. I didn't know what else to do. I just waited for him to come home. And he comes through the door, and boy, I had seen him angry, but never that angry. Never that angry. And he came and he said, you embarrass me in front of my friends. I was his fourth wife. I really thought I was the one that was going to make the difference, you know. And you know, anger, it was just going to be a horrible thing. We know what anger sounds like. It's lamps against the wall, plates against the floor, skin against skin. We know what anger sounds like. And because I was so organized, I'm just trying to buy some time. I said, why don't we go see that doctor? This is going to be a bad fight. Why don't we just go see this doctor? Now, you had to go and call the doctor and make an appointment like weeks ahead of time. But just to buy some time, I ducked around. I called the doctor, and the young lady that answered the phone said, well, isn't this interesting? Somebody just canceled, and if you can be here in 15 minutes, the doctor can see you. God had stepped into my life, and I didn't even know it. So I said, we can go see the doctor right now. And if you think that anger is noisy, silent anger is absolutely deadly. The silent anger in that car going to see the doctor was absolutely frightening. And so we go in to see this doctor, the one that twirled the paperclip. We sat down beside him. And he came around on his side of the desk and he said, before I start listening to you, I need to say something. My name is Dr. So-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I need to make amends to my patients because I haven't always been as present as I should have been. So from that time to the time before, the man had gotten into recovery, and he was a changed person. He was present. His face was soft and gentle. He was aware of what we were saying, and he picked up right away what was going on in my household because his household had been living it. They were in all of the right clubs, too. The only thing that might have been a little different about my husband that he tapped into right away was that my husband was also a cocaine addict. Actually, he was a cocaine entrepreneur. That's drug dealer when you live on a nice neighborhood, okay? And you better believe some crazy things were going on in that household. So this doctor said, look, to make amends to you, he said, my wife and I were going to go to this week-long couples retreat, and we can't go, and things were different then. So he handed us the schedule. He handed us their tickets. And like the next day, we're on an airplane to go to South Dakota to a week-long couples retreat in a treatment center. We have had no knowledge of what treatment's about, alcoholism, addiction, nothing. In fact, we arrive at this treatment center, and my second husband always said that a plane was one of his very favorite bars. So this is the way we kind of got to this treatment center. He'd had a good time on the airplane, and I'm absolutely exhausted. And we walk into this treatment center, and there were the two banners, the traditions and the steps. And just to have something to do, I walk over and I look at those steps, and there's that word unmanageable. And I thought, isn't that strange that that keeps showing up in my vocabulary? You know, because I manage. So we're at this week-long couples retreat. And let me tell you what it looks like. They had a really pleasant little lake, and the couples would hold hands, and they'd walk around the lake. And then the couples would hold hands, and they'd go into dinner. And then the couples would hold hands, and they'd go up to their room. I'm standing there one day, and I'm thinking, this place looks like Noah's Ark. I mean, everybody's walking around in twosies, you know. And every time it was our turn to talk about our marriage, our relationship, they would take my husband over into the other room. And I would be standing out there like, how can we work on our marriage if they have him in the other room? And what they were doing, they were trying to break down the wall of his denial on his addictions to alcohol, drugs, and some other hobbies that wouldn't really benefit a marriage, okay? And they were trying to save his life. I know that now, but I didn't then. I'm going, this is a week lost from work. This is a waste of time. Oh, okay, so I learned the Serenity Prayer. Great, you know. But as we were leaving that place, the head of it, the director of it, gave me this tremendous bear hug. And he whispered in my ear, get yourself to Al-Anon. Now, we're in the Black Hills of South Dakota. I thought Al-Anon must be an Indian word. You know? I didn't have a clue. I did not have a clue. So we go back to Nashville, Tennessee to live happily ever after. And we don't have the tool of denial. Denial is a pretty good tool to have. You don't have to look at anything. You don't have to change any behavior. But now we're out of denial, and we're right in the river. And things got really bad fast. And weekends were really long at our house. I could head out at work during the week, but weekends were really long. And we'd had a really rough weekend, and I'm at my very organized desk on Monday, and I am falling apart. And I'm not a woman that falls apart. I'm a businesswoman. I take on attorneys. I take on people that develop shopping centers. And I am falling apart. And I picked up the phone book, and I looked up the word Al-Anon, and I called this woman. Now, how can I say what's going on? Because I have no idea what's really going on, okay? All I have is this hole that I've been carrying around now for 40 years. I'd been carrying around this hole for 40 years and stuffing men, stuffing anything I could in here to try to fill it up. And so she says, where are you? And I tell her, and she says, the Methodist Publishing House just started a meeting on Monday at 12 noon. It's about 10 o'clock in the morning. And I look at my planner, and I don't have a power lunch, and so I've kind of calmed down. And she says, I want you to go over to that meeting, and she says, I want you to listen to what they have to say. They'll tell you about Al-Anon. They'll give you some literature. Just go over there. And I'm so desperate, I heard that. Just go to the meeting. I heard that. And by the time I hang up, I've kind of calmed down, and I'm thinking, okay, I'll just go. I don't have a power lunch. They probably want me just donate some money. You know, okay, I'll go over there because she said so. And I go over to the Methodist Publishing House, and I have to tell you that's still my home group. 20 years. That meeting was absolutely incredible for me. It saved my life. But I want to tell you who the woman was that had her hand on the doorknob outside of her very first Al-Anon meeting. Man, if you saw me, you'd think I was all together. You know, I wore nice business suits. I wore silk dresses. I got things done. They'd call me at night at 10 o'clock and tell me at school they needed 112 cupcakes by in the morning. I can do that. Whatever you need done, I can do that. You know, this is a time that I am rocking and rolling on doing stuff. I am a doer. I'm a shaker, and I'm a mover. And I look back on those days, and I know that one thing I was trying to do on a daily basis, that I was trying to please the disease. That's why I was so busy. I was trying to please the disease, and you can't. The disease wants more. It wants all of you. It is greedy, and it is mean, and it wants all of you. Our household, my husband is bottoming out on his drugs and alcohol, and he no longer has denial. He's got to look at it. My teenage daughter in high school is beginning her journey into drugs and alcohol. My 8-year-old daughter, her body has turned into that of a teenager at 8 years old. Her hormones are bouncing off the wall. The mother, the one that's in charge, I have no spiritual connect, and I'm in premenopause. You think our house wasn't a war zone? It was a war zone. We had separate TVs. We had separate bedrooms. You did not have eye contact in the hallway because it wasn't safe. We did not share meals. We did not share anything but losing the battle against the disease of alcoholism. I had my hand on that doorknob, and I looked good, and I'm falling apart. And I opened up that doorknob, and I swear the first thing I said was, "What's that noise?" And from the meeting, they said, "That's laughter. Come on in." Because, you know, it had been a long time since I'd heard that wonderful belly laughter that we're able to share together in recovery. I think that laughter is the sound effect of recovery. I think that laughter is the most instant meditation that we can do. I'm talking about safe laughter. Now, in my household growing up, we had sarcasm that looked like laughter. But my Al-Anon book tells me sarcasm is ripping of the flesh. It's from the Greek word, tearing of the flesh. So sarcasm was laughing at somebody else's expense. But what I've learned in Al-Anon is an agreement that Scott and I have. You cannot tease anybody over something they can't correct in 10 minutes. If you say to somebody, "Well, I see you've got an extra spare tire around your waist," that's sarcasm because they can't correct that in 10 minutes. But if they do something like I do something all the time, I can't even think of them, but Scott laughs a lot. And there are things in the moment, you know, we're not teasing each other about things that we can't change. But anyway, so I learned about safe laughter, okay? Now, I am still married to this second husband, and I did what I know people in early Al-Anon do. We say, keep the focus on you, not the alcoholic. But believe me, I sang the hymns. In early Al-Anon, I sang the hymns. Him did this and him did that, you know. And y'all let me stay. You let me stay and you let me be a part of it. And I took to Al-Anon like I was taken to oxygen for the first time. Now, I had a sponsor that she actually said, you're not going to get in service work right away because you'll get in, you'll try to be president. Because, see, I would hide out in activity. And she says, we don't have president. She said, you're not well enough to do service work. So she got me into the steps. I had a loving sponsor that took me through the steps. I think now we're going to live happily ever after. We've got recovery. We've got this marriage. We've got these businesses. It's just going to be wonderful. But it wasn't meant to be. Because I got well enough in Al-Anon to know that there were some things that it was okay for me to ask for in a marriage contract. And it was okay for me to ask for those things, but if he was in a place where he couldn't give those, then that was okay too. So we 2 years in recovery, we got a divorce, and it was a horrible business divorce. It went on forever. I learned a lot about divorce. My sponsor helped me so much. She said, divorce is not a place to make amends. It's a business contract. She said, divorce isn't anything else about the marriage any more than wedding is about the marriage, okay? It's something completely separate, and she held my hand through that. And she was a wonderful sponsor for me because she would tell me the truth. One day I came in all from a business trip, and we for 3 years we had to live in the same house. I lived upstairs, and he lived downstairs, because if you abandon your household in Tennessee, you give up a lot. So we lived in the same house. You talk about happy ever after. Whoa. But anyway, I come home one time, and I call my sponsor because I feel awful. And the pets are at the kennels. The kids are gone. You know, I'm going through this divorce, and I call my sponsor, and I said, I just feel like I have been so rejected. And she says, you have been. And it was amazing that when I hear the truth, I have a chance to react in a truthful way. That was a turning point for me. I had a chance to react in a honest way. So I would like to say that we lived happily ever after, but it just wasn't meant to be. We divorced, and I keep this man in my prayers. I have to say, probably not every day, but most days, because he was the vehicle that got me to Al-Anon. And Al-Anon absolutely is something that absolutely saved my life. I'm talking about in early recovery. Well, I'll just tell this. I learned about detachment. You know, if you ever want to know how to treat adults, get this little pamphlet on detachment. It says not to wake them up, not to help them eat, not to help them pay bills, not to help them not drink. It's let the adults in your life be adults, okay? If you want to know how to let the adults in your life be adults, get in touch of detachment. So I've kind of been getting that. And the slogans. I love the slogans because that's the only thing that could get through this, you know, this committee going off all the time, and I'd kind of gotten detachment. And then one day, this man that I was married to, a situation came up, and two adults were fighting over a gun. That does not have a good ending. Two adults fighting over a gun, and it's almost like I heard behind me somebody from my home group say, detach, because I had a hold of his arm like this, and I saved his life and my life because I detached and I backed way off. Okay. So I literally, Al-Anon saved my life that day. It's a way of life for me. It changed my life, and I started living happily ever after. Okay, I got active in service work. I had made amends to family members. I had I'd gotten on with the life. I wasn't so caught up in work all the time. I'm still busy. I'm doing great. I've been divorced quite a while. I'm not really dating. I'm kind of lonely. I had turned my house into a safe place for women and children during this time. And we had a blast during this time. No matter what our budget was, somebody would always have enough money to bring flowers home. So when we'd have our dinner once a week all together, we would have flowers on the table. We would get dressed up, thinking we were going to go out in the town. That meant we would go to a meeting. You know, I had a lot of AA women living there and children. And one day on my knees, I said a prayer. I didn't ask for anything. I just said, God, I'm lonely. That's all. And to look at my life, it wouldn't seem like I was lonely because I had a cat, a dog, a rabbit, a gerbil, a fish. Scott said when he met me, I had a food chain living in my house. It didn't seem like I would be lonely with all of that. I still had one daughter living at home. But I said that prayer, I'm lonely. And one of the women living there, we were talking. I said, you know, I said this prayer the other day. I didn't really ask for anything, but I just told God that I was lonely. And she said, well, didn't you know Scott's divorce was going to be final in a couple of weeks? I said, Scott, from the meeting? See, I had been going to an open AA meeting for the same amount of time I'd been going to Al-Anon, because that's what my Al-Anon sponsor taught me. She said, you go to open AA meetings, and you sit there, and you shut up. You never say a word, you never share, you never speak at an AA meeting. You're not there. You're not an AA. But I want you to hear the stories of hope, and I want you to have an understanding about the disease of alcoholism. And that's where you're going to find out. That's where you're going to do your research. So now this girlfriend tells me that Scott is going to be divorced in a couple of weeks, and I had seen him at the meeting for... Well, we've been married 13 years, so I guess I'd seen you for 7 years. I don't do math really well. I guess I'd been watching you for 7 years, and I thought I love whatever he shared. I thought his household must be wonderful. I'm having him living happily ever after wherever he is. And now I've got this information that he's going to be single. I said, I didn't even know he's having trouble. And she says, he hasn't lived in his house for like 3 years. Where have you been? And I thought, that was information I wasn't supposed to have, because that's just about as long as I'd been single for 3 years. You know, I wasn't supposed to know that, I guess. So I guess I started acting different. I don't know. I wasn't aware of it, except I'm kind of going around. Scott's going to be single. I'm lonely. Scott's going to be single. I'm lonely. So I guess I changed my behavior, because I'm leaving the meeting one day, this open AA meeting one Saturday, and Scott steps right in front of me, and he says, can I ask you something? I said, yes. He said, have I done something to offend you? And I said, no. Why do you ask that? And he said, well, he said, you know, you don't go to lunch with us anymore. You don't have eye contact. You don't stay around and share in the hugs or talk about, you know, talk after the meeting. He says, I just wonder if I'd done something to offend you. See, I'd changed my behavior with the information that I had, that he was going to be single. So I said, well, I found out that you're going to be single, and I'm interested. He said, oh. And I bolted for my pickup truck. And we didn't have cell phones. I didn't have my cell phone then. And I had to wait till I got home. And I called my sponsor. I said, blah, 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 blah. And she said, I think it'll be okay because you told the truth. It's amazing. After going through these steps, I was able to connect with some of my truths. And then I was able to speak some of my truths. And that certainly gave you a chance at responding in a truthful manner. You know, I can trust what I get back from you if I'm not trying to control, manipulate you in any way. Then I can trust what I get back if I'm not playing the games. I can only trust the games. If I get what I want by playing the games, I can only trust the games and play more games. But if I let go of all of that and speak my truth, I can believe what I get back. So Scott asked me out, and we started dating, and we started courting. And then he asked me, he said, I've heard you say several times that you'll never get married again, because I had said that. And it took me a long time to know what I was saying. What I was saying was, I'll never get divorced again. And so the only way I knew not to get divorced was not get married. You know, that was, I'm pretty logical about that. And he said, I've heard you say, we were in a committed relationship. And he said, I heard you say that you'd never get married again, but I would like you to marry me. And I said, yes. And I'm going, where did that come from? I mean, this was a year and a half into our courtship that this happened. And 13 years ago, we're living happily ever after, you know. And I want to tell you what it looks like in a very active Al-Anon and a very active AA home. He's got a AA telephone line, and I've got an Al-Anon telephone line. We find that it doesn't work for him to sponsor the husband and me to sponsor the wife. That just doesn't work. We sponsor a lot of people. I think that we've had some agreements that we took into our relationship, into our marriage, and one of them would be that we will not work each other's program. But we can ask at any given time two questions and without the other person getting upset. And those questions are, how long has it been since you've been to a meeting? Okay. If my meeting count gets low, I get a spiritual flat tire and my behavior shows it. And the other question we can ask at any given time is, would you be willing to talk to your sponsor about that? Which means we both have sponsors, okay? And we can ask each other those questions without and the other person getting upset. Okay. Are y'all okay back there on the back row? Did she write those down? I think it'll be okay. And our marriage is like a railroad track. I like to use this vision. I grew up in West Texas, very flat. And if you stood on a railroad track, it really looked like the two rails eventually touched. It's an optical illusion, because if you go on down the railroad track, that point of contact moves on down too. And that's the way I describe Scott and I in our marriage. He is one rail, I am one rail, but we have a shared vision. And that shared vision is that we are going to keep God first, our program second, and we're going to be third. And sometimes we're fourth or fifth. He gets a big business deal going on. Our oldest daughter's pregnant with twins. She and her husband move into our household for 4 months. She took up a lot of my time. He got bounced down to about fourth place on my list. But we do have this shared vision on what we want retirement to look like, our shared vision that we're going to have a date on Wednesday, every Wednesday starting at 3:30. That means we turn off the phones and we don't take calls from sponsees, because if we don't plan our time together, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. And we like being together, but we forget. So we put each other on the calendar. It's not a big thing, and it's not an unkind thing. It's actually a loving thing. So we're the separate rails. The ties are our connectedness, and the shared vision is that point of contact that's out there. And all of this is possible because I am a member of Al-Anon. Through Al-Anon, I got a God of my understanding, I got a me of my understanding, and I got an incredible you of my understanding. Okay? Before I got into Al-Anon, the God that I brought to you was that God that we talk about that you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley, a judging God, a God that wasn't on my side, that wasn't even available, you know, that just, you know, but the God that I found through Al-Anon is an incredible God. This God, it's like it says in the steps, I think it starts out that a power greater than ourselves, than God as we understood him, God as we understood. And then you get over to the traditions, and it says a loving God. We finally put an adjective in front of God, a loving God. This is the process that I found, this loving God. And what I know about this God is on my side and is also bigger than all the monsters under the bed. Okay? This is the God that I needed to hold my hand while I went into that dark cave of 6 and 7. No, the dark cave of 4 and 5. I'll do it that way. My observation is, I did 4 and 5. I was a feisty girl. My sponsor did not fall asleep during my 5th step. I was out there. But that's not who I am. But it's who I used to be. And they were survival tools. I used the bedroom inappropriate to control, reward, manipulate. I also had a lot of grieving to do around step 5. And I had to grieve the loss of the dreams. I really believed that first man and I were going to live happily ever after. I really believed the disease would never touch my children, that we would be protected from it, okay? I had to grieve the loss of the dreams. But most of my damage as an Al-Anon person actually come from my defects of character. My observation has been, 4 and 5 for the alcoholics that are out there, in their feisty way of doing whatever, getting arrested, stealing money, whatever they're out there doing. My damage came from my defects of character, control, punishment, manipulation, perfectionism. That's how I did my damage. My defects of character absolutely tore people up. And I know now my defects of character, when I get those voices in my head, it's the voices of my defects of character. And I say, I hear you all. Line up. I'm going to have to talk to you one at a time. Okay? And there's a wonderful line in our Courage to Change book. It says, being human is not a character defect. And that changed my life when I read that one. So I've got the God of my understanding. I got the me of my understanding. I'm just a human being. I can tell you what I like to do, who I like to hang out with, and I never could before. It was always what you wanted to do. I couldn't pick restaurants because it wouldn't be safe, because if we got bad service, it was my fault. Okay? It was really hard for me to take step 1. I was given a lot of power under the heading of blame. If I got blamed for the car having a flat tire, that must mean I also had the duty or the ability to make you happy. So step 1 was really connected with who I am. And that's all. That's just me. I just am who I am. The you of my understanding, before Al-Anon, I put you in 2 categories. If you were female, you were after my man, and if you were a man, you were after me. That's the way I divided the whole world. And what I know that what you are is... I look down at this first step and I see who you are. They said, hang out with the winners. Number 1, we. You're in first place. It says it right there. And then it says restore. That word restore, nothing gets restored unless it had been something of worth and value. So you are winners and you have worth and value. You are worthy of restoration. You're worthy of recovery. Okay? My disease is also one of amnesia. I forget what my spiritual awakening is as a result of working these steps. And because I have amnesia, I have to go back to a little story. My incredible spiritual awakening was that I have choices. I never knew I had choices. I never knew I had choices to say yes. I never knew I had choices to say no. Yes, I can go to a meeting. Yes, I can call my sponsor. No, I can be a brat and hide under the covers. I've got choices today that I never knew I had. But I forget that. I'm going to close with this little story. Long ago, far, far away, there was this village, and there was an old man in this village, and everybody loved him. He was just so gentle and loving and caring. They just loved this old man. And there was a young boy in the village. I guess in this day and time, we'd say this young boy had an attitude, and he was jealous of the old man, and he was always trying to trip him up, okay? So the young boy came up with a scheme one day, and it was a great scheme. It was a great scheme. The little boy said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to catch a baby bird, and I'm going to put it behind my back, and I'm going to go to the old man, and I'm going to ask the old man if this bird is dead or alive. And if the old man said, well, son, that bird is dead, well, then I'm going to show him the live bird. Or if he says, well, son, that bird is alive, well, then the boy said, I'm going to squeeze the bird and kill it, and I'm going to show the old man the dead bird. What a great scheme. So they call all the village around to watch. The young boy catches this baby bird, and he puts it behind his back, and he says, okay, old man, you tell me whether this bird is dead or alive. And without hesitation, the old man said, son, the choice is yours. So if you're there at those crossroads or crossroad of should I call my sponsor or should I go to a meeting, you've got it right there behind your back. The choice is yours. There is not a person in this room that I could not hand this card to. You're absolutely lovable, adorable, attracted to you. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love people in recovery. Thank you for letting me share. God bless. Thank you.